he never seemed to forgive his mother for having an affair with a boarder, and the fact that they were having sex in the next room, or maybe he saw something.
That's the gist of it. This is a secret he kept. He only spoke of it twice in his life, and I find that remarkable. In this 1976 letter to his mother, where he says to her, and then we're talking about, so now it's 1944 is when this occurs, and he writes to her in 1976, and he's trying to explain to her that things have gotten very bad between him and her, because they've moved back, the Richards have moved back to Canada, so Lily's much more proximate. She's literally down the hill in Westmount from them. And as things have gotten strange, she's behaving badly towards the children, she's behaving badly towards Florence, and he just says, I'm going to take care of it, I'm going to end this. Well, he doesn't say I'm going to end, I'm going to take care of this. And what he does is he writes this long, devastating, sorrowful, furious letter to her.
Wow, what a, I mean...
Yeah, takes your head off.
That letter is just stunning, doesn't even start.
Yes, I've read it dozens of times and I'm still taken aback by it.
He used, probably except for Florence, everybody as comic fodder.
Yes.
And he outraged the Jews in Montreal, of which he had been a pretty important member. His grandfather had been a rabbi. He outrages the English in Canada by saying that we're pale imitations basically of Americans and gutless, and then you think the French Canadians would like that, but no. Then he takes on the separatists.
He was an equal opportunity offender in that regard, and of those, and you described very well, I think, the three principal tussles of his adult life. And what struck me as I was writing the book is that Jewish Canadians, Jewish Montrealers, they didn't like this kid, but they got him. They knew where he was coming from. They understood the tradition he was emerging from. They understood Judaism, the value placed on judgment, on conflict, on asking questions. English Canadians really didn't know where he was coming from at the start. But over time, we kind of got used to him. He was this big, burly presence who spoke to us in ways that no one else did. French Canadians, French Quebecers, it was a mismatch. There was no conversation. They honestly did not know where this man was coming from. They did not know why he thought he could speak to them that way. They certainly didn't understand why a local, a Montrealer, albeit an Anglo-Montrealer, would go out of his way to humiliate the province internationally. In their minds, the province. In Richler's mind, he was humiliating the nationalist project. And he said that, I'm going to humiliate them internationally. And he did. And they never forgave him.
He's always trying to write the great novel, and he actually succeeds several times. I mean, you sort of read and go, oh yeah, well, that's, the horseman, that's got to be the great. And then he writes, there's Cocksure, and you go, yeah, but yeah. That's kind of like the, and then, Gursky, and then Barney's version. And you keep going, well, did he ever get what he really wanted to get out of novels?
Two things. First, I agree. What struck me about his career by the time I'd sort of gone through it once was that he wrote very, very good novels over 5 decades. And that achievement, I think, is underplayed because they were so spaced out. And oftentimes, I think we were readers of one generation weren't reading the earlier generation's books, with the exception of Dodie, which was on the canon for a while, but even that's fallen away, Dodie Kravitz. The point about Richler's often stated conviction that the job of a novelist is to write one book that lasts, and he believed that, is that it is sort of the carrot that the writer puts in front of his stick, right? It is a way of getting yourself out of bed every morning. He no doubt went to his grave believing he hadn't done that. The public, people's choice would be that Barney's version was that great book. It has that greater depth of humanity and emotion, and the underlay of it is quite a bit more humane than his other books because of the theme of Alzheimer's and aging. And then, in my view, Solomon Gursky Was Here is his greatest book and maybe the finest book written by a Canadian. That remains a minority view, though, and possibly, though he not only ever said it, that was his greatest frustration. That book, while acclaimed, didn't really find its audience.
Where do we see Richler, and why should we, and how should we?
He is a singular figure, and he's simultaneously a Canadian icon and a singular, almost outsider figure. It's a very distinctive position. He asserted it. He asserted his that he could be at once a Canadian, and he felt he was Canadian by default. There was nothing to be done about it. As he said once, all my attitudes are Canadian. And yet, operated from the outside, was, as I say at one point, an elderly statesman minus the state. So he's always going to be a slightly uneasy part of our canon, but that is what ought to make him canonical. That is what ought to make him, in a way, the most distinctive Canadian voice, because he doesn't quite fit in. And increasingly, Canada is a culture, a literary culture, of all these different voices. I think to this day, that's where he ought to be viewed, as simultaneously our most an essential Canadian voice, and yet a distinctive one, almost unique.
The book is Mordecai, The Life and Times. I've been speaking with his biographer, Charles Foran, and Mordecai, The Life and Times, published by Knopf Canada.